welcome to episode 2 of season 2, the 12th episode overall of People Are the Answer. I truly believe that people are the only answer to the world's many problems. I'm Jeffrey M. Zucker, a serial entrepreneur here to learn how innovators are creating outsized, transformational social impact. Today's episode features Jake Cloberdans, founder of One Hope Wine, where they empower people to share wine and give hope. One Hope is one of the fastest growing private businesses in the US and one of the top 250 wineries in the country, all while maintaining their profit for purpose values. Through One Hope, they've donated over $7 million to various nonprofits. Jake is also the founder of multiple cannabis brands, serves on the board of Rebuild North Bay, and is an advisor to venture firm 8VC. Jake has been recognized with a variety of prestigious awards, and he also played football and rugby for UC Berkeley. Jake has infectious personality and passion, and they've served him well over the years. Jake and I discussed all of that and more in our awesome discussion. Here is Jake Cloberdans on People Are the Answer. Jake, thanks so much for joining me on People Are the Answer.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I'm excited to spend a little time talking.
Likewise, and could you start off by just telling us your background, you know, where you're based, your current role?
Yeah. So my name is Jake Cloberdans, and I founded One Hope about 14 years ago, back in 2007. And really, it dates back even a little further than that, as do most businesses. Their established date is a little later than when it actually started. And I am the CEO and co-founder with a handful of other people who have devoted the majority of our careers together to building towards this purpose to nourish the future with One Hope. And then I also have a role leading up our real estate and hospitality company, which is the property behind me, kind of that started with it, and have a vision to expand that internationally as well, and play a little bit of interesting roles on a couple of boards and on one other portfolio of brands in another industry, tangential industry. And so definitely keep busy, but the majority of my days when it comes to work and play are with One Hope and what we're doing there with building our brand distribution and technology company.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to digging into some of that. Appreciate you sharing. Some of it came through in your recent answer, but, and you talked about nourishing the future, but what motivates you in general?
Yeah. I think finding that purpose and finding why you are put here on earth and why you are given, you know, everything from blessings to challenges is what motivates me, right? Curiosity. And this searching for your greater purpose to the rest of the world and to the people around you. And so I think that's why I've chosen my career to be focused on that, because I think a lot of people leave that purpose to after they get off of work, trying to figure that out and find joy and find purpose and fulfillment. And I get to do it every day. And so I think that's the main driving force. And then having great people around you is, you know, the other driving force of putting yourself around people who are trying to solve big challenges and make those around them better and are leaders. That's inspiring, and it keeps me, you know, wanting to do that. Yeah.
That's inspiring in itself. And in sort of this project I've been undergoing of talking to as many innovators and social impact as I can, it definitely seems like a lot of them are following their passion, and that is the fuel to their fire.
Yeah, it seems like a common thread to me too. So I agree.
So where did you grow up and what was it like?
I grew up in Fremont, California. It was, it's pretty, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say a rural town, but it's definitely a suburbs of the Silicon Valley. And there weren't a lot of things that people would know Fremont by. It was the last BART stop on one of the main routes. So a lot of people kind of recognized it from that. Today, you know, the big Tesla plant there, that was the NUMMI plant. And so while I was growing up, it was the NUMMI plant. The Tesla plant's something that people know Fremont by. And I don't know that many people are aware of it, but it was like the original Hollywood for California before Hollywood existed. And Charlie Chaplin kind of settled there in an area of town called the Niles Canyon and made a lot of his films there and stuff. And so, but it was nothing like Hollywood. It was just, I lived in a nice kind of community. And I went to a high school that was like the highest rated public high school in California. And it had all these like children of mostly immigrants who came over here to build amazing companies. And because of that, it, you know, my average class, it was super driven and it was a very competitive school. And I was lucky to be around a lot of the kids because of their intellect and their work ethic combined. And so that was my hometown, Fremont. I was born in Chico, California, while my folks were going to college there. So that's my first couple of years of life, but the rest of it, I grew up in Fremont.
Awesome. Well, in particular, that high school experience sounds really interesting and rewarding and one that, you know, you were fortunate to have.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Just kind of getting dropped in with a lot of smart people around you, a lot of driven people, definitely set the pace from an early age and really junior high too. So it was kind of the feeder into the high school. And I started out when I was first going into grade school, I was in an area of Fremont. Fremont's a big town, and it was one of the first master plan cities in the country. And so it has these different regions of it, and all of them have their own high school system. And I was in the part of town that was mostly Hispanic growing up as a young kid. So I went to a school that was bilingual. And it was only bilingual because we're here in America, but like the primary language really felt like Spanish, you know? And so I got a different experience there. I was going to school with people who were in a totally different socio-demographic economic demographic than where I ended up. Then my parents moved and bought their first home in a district called the Washington District. And that was kind of more of a blue collar, I would say, area, so somewhere in the middle. And then the last place we ended up was in the Mission District. And once I moved to the Mission District, as I noted, you had a lot of successful families that were mostly immigrants, either first gen or second generation. And it was kind of like, you know, we would get shit from other high schools, call us Sugar Hill and stuff like that, because it did have a little bit more wealth. And so I got to go through kind of those three phases of school and friends in those areas. It was pretty unique upbringing. So.
Yeah, it seems like you got, despite being in sort of one area of the country, you got to experience a variety of types of people and cultures.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, from an early age, I was aware that there was a big disparity of people's households and stuff, because I had a couple friends who, you know, were from well-off households. And then I also had a couple friends who were like on meal programs, you know, and had like food insecure homes. And so I think that stuck with me, even though over the years, my mom is an entrepreneur. So she started her business, you know, very much from the ground floor, like out of the home, you know, and as, you know, her career and my dad's career grew, they kind of moved their way into these different areas. But I never forgot about, you know, the different people that I was friends with or went to school with during these different times. So
that's great. Yeah, I definitely find that how you grow up, who you meet, who you experience, what you experience certainly helps make an entrepreneur.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think it's a big part of my story and a big part of our story at One Hope. I mean, at One Hope, we share wine and give hope, and we empower people to really be in the wine business. So we've democratized the Napa Valley wine tasting experience, but we've also democratized the opportunity to have your own wine business. And 99% of the people who are in our community who have those wine businesses on our platform, they're women, and over half of them are moms. And so as I look back at like my childhood and just like the gifts I was given from the beginning of being located in the Silicon Valley and growing up with a mom who was in, you know, doing marketing and in specifically on technology and software and hardware and stuff like that, and getting introduced to brands and technology at a young age, having wine country in our backyard and discovering that through college, and then also having this kind of thread of entrepreneurship. And at that, my mom and my grandma being the entrepreneurs in our family, it's not surprising that now, as I look back, that I ended up building a you know, tech-enabled platform for women entrepreneurs to share wine and give hope. And it's like all these things that intersected from my childhood without me kind of realizing it. And it starts to make you think that it's your destiny, you know, and that's what you were meant to do in this world.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I'd like to dig more into how you're empowering those business owners. But to start, I'm curious, you know, what initially got you into the wine industry?
I was working at Gallo, actually, the largest wine company in the world, an amazing family-owned wine business. And, you know, I never knew anything about wine. I was going to UC Berkeley. I kind of checked all the boxes for Gallo's, this national program they had called their management development program, where they would kind of search for candidates that were a certain type of prototype. I played sports in college. I was involved in my fraternity. I was our social chair and philanthropy chair. And I also had, you know, business school background, stuff like that. And so it kind of checked all the boxes for them. And they threw me into this room with a handful of other people and started teaching us about the wine business. And it started with learning wine and learning about sales of wine in stores. And that's what got me in there. And then I kind of fell in love with the industry.
It's great to hear. And it sounds like it just kind of happened. You kind of got thrown into it in a way.
Yep. I think it came looking for me, you know. Gallo recruited me pretty hard. And I had a bunch of other like finance companies trying to hire me out of college. I was at UC Berkeley here in the Bay Area, and I had a bunch of local groups, and then a couple of groups out of New York that were interested in hiring me. And this was the only sales job I was offered and that I really interviewed for. And a couple people were like, hey, you should go this route. Gallo is a great training grounds, and you're going to be an entrepreneur. That was what a couple of my business professors told me. And they were like, you need to learn how to sell, and they're one of the best. So it turns out that they were really good at teaching me about wine, stuff like that. I think I always had a kind of a natural tendency to share a vision with enthusiasm and to build relationships. And that's, I think, what people drill down to sales. Sometimes you get offended as a visionary of a company when people are like, you're a great salesman. And I'm like, I'm more than a salesman. But at the core, you know, we're all selling a vision and sharing a vision with enthusiasm. And so I've tried to not take that personally anymore when people tell me I'm a great salesman. Yeah.
No, I get where you're coming from with that, but I think having great sales skills is an awesome thing to have in your repertoire.
Definitely. And I have them to thank for giving me that first taste of formal sales training, and then also, you know, showing me wine country and the romantic side of the wine business to go alongside the industrial side of it, which they're good at both of them.
So what was the path from that initial experience with Gallo to creating One Hope?
Well, so after I left college, you know, I go from being, you know, involved in student government and being on a national championship rugby team and being thinking I was hot shit to getting thrown in the back of grocery stores, down stacking pallets, and stocking shelves, you know, and that was how you built relationships was, and I happened to be good at manual labor at the time because I was still in really good shape. And so I would show up at like 3:30, 4 in the morning. I'd have my box cutter on my hip and I was ready to do work. I rolled my sleeves and I would stock shelves with Campbell's soup and yogurt and stuff like that, not just wine, to build relationships with the liquor manager because they don't really care that you think you're a hotshot coming out of some, you know, good school or something. They're like, dude, what can you do for me to help me run my store better? And a lot of it's manual labor. People forget that when the stores are shelves are shopped, that some people come in at night and they restock all of that stuff. And there's a lot of work behind the scenes to make those stores look beautiful and merchandising and stuff. And so that's what I was doing. And one of those days when I was literally stocking Campbell's soup to an end cap, I noticed the pink ribbon on the can and it said, this can helps against the fight against breast cancer. And then I went to the milk box to stock Yoplait yogurt. And I noticed the Danone yogurt was like totally filled up and the Yoplait was totally shopped. And I saw on their foil lids that you could send in the lids for a 10-cent donation to the fight against breast cancer. And so it hit me two in a row. And that was the morning when I was in the wine aisle. I was like, I didn't see anything in the wine aisle, any wines giving back towards different causes. And I was like, it'd be really cool if a brand gave back year round in the wine industry. And it wasn't, that was also the breakthrough, you know, a couple weeks later when all the pink ribbons were gone and October was over and Breast Cancer Awareness Month was gone, that it'd be even cooler if that brand gave back year round instead of just as a temporary marketing campaign. And so that was the idea for One Hope. And I did what most people do, you know, when they have a really great idea, which is nothing. I did nothing with it for like 6 months. And then I had one of my best friends from childhood call me and she shared the news that she had blood cancer. And that was in April. So it was about a half a year later. And that was like most great things. It's like you have a great idea, but there's some pressing mechanism. And that was it. And I told her I was going to go home and see her the next day. And I flew home to see her. And I told her about this idea. And I told her I was going to start it while she was going through her fight with cancer. And so I flew home the next day and I incorporated the business. It was incorporated on April 20th of 2006. And by June 1st, 2007, we really recognized that as the true launching date when we were driving the first, you know, 3 pallets of wine down to, and we were in business. But that was the day I incorporated it. And she's still alive today and has been cancer free for a decade and she has 3 kids. And so it's a really positive story. She's a teacher down in Arizona and we keep in touch all the time still. But that was how I came to start One Hope, a combination of a need in the market, but also a life-changing moment that kind of put me in touch with my mortality as a young man.
Yeah, it's fascinating to hear about sort of that catalyst moment that drove you to execute on the idea that you'd had.
Yeah, I think that moment, it scared me and it made me realize like life is short, but it also made me super brave at the same time because life is short. And, you know, it made me jump to what I wanted to do when I retired, which was be an old man and own a vineyard and be a philanthropist. And so I got to combine all those at the young age of my early 20s instead of waiting till I was 70 and had done everything I wanted to in business.
That's awesome. I love the idea of finding creative ways to be able to work on your passions and especially in ways that provide positive social impact. And I'm curious when you saw, you know, the breast cancer awareness stuff in the store and noticed that there wasn't anything in wine, had you already had the concept in mind of potentially creating a social enterprise?
Yes and no. I didn't have like real form around it, but you know, my interest in creating a social enterprise dates back to really going, I was in Haas Business School undergrad at Berkeley. And my first class, you apply after your sophomore year and then your first classes are over the summer. And They were, it was a social enterprise class, and it was about business and philanthropy and social impact. And that was the first time I really heard the phrase intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation, and came to understand how most people in organizations are equally or more motivated by the intangibles that aren't monetary. And after you get people to a certain level of monetary security, it's really about those intrinsic motivators. And I knew that at that stage in learning about it, which is really ironic. It was the summer of, like, Enron had just gone down, and it was in Anderson Auditorium, you know, sponsored by their accounting firm. And I kind of laughed about taking my social impact class in Anderson Auditorium while all that shit was going on. But I really got inspired by this idea that businesses could be a force for good, and that you could also do a lot of good by inspiring your employees with intrinsic motivation at the same time. Yeah, I think that's the beginning of it. And then other than that, like, through seeing how my mom as an entrepreneur and her business, like, impacted people's lives, you know, having family that was generous and always giving back, even before they had much to give back, was always something that resonated with me as well. So I think all those are, like, little data points looking back that have culminated in me building One Hope, and that being a natural idea that came for me.
Well, going back to what I said about innovators and social impact generally, you know, having a lot of influence from their childhood and their growing up, and as it did with you, so often their family and their parents come up in terms of setting the example, even if they didn't necessarily have the same means. Can you talk a little bit more about how your family inspired you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, growing up, I always knew that my dad had met my mom in the while he was in the army, and they were on a base in Germany. And so these stories and pictures that you see of your parents when they're young, being in service to our country and serving in a sort, being adventurous and exploring. And then, you know, that, like, kind of sense of duty and work ethic that they both carried. All those are parts of who I am. And then, you know, later on, seeing the ingenuity you know, relentlessness and resilience of building a business, with watching my mom build her business in the market research space, being put in a position where when I'd go to work with her, I'd get to be behind a two-way mirror and watch her do a focus group with people and moderate it and watch people connect with brands and stuff. And watch people do usability tests and test video games and software and things like that, and start to understand how people navigate a computer screen all the way to how they connect with something that's as kind of amorphous as a brand. Those are all, like, things that I think about when I think about my parents and how they're connected to what I built. My dad was, you know, in construction our whole life. So also watching him build physical spaces and be committed to a project that might take 4 or 5 years to complete. He started kind of, like, at the ground floor in construction and worked his way up to being a project manager for Stanford University. And I saw these great buildings that he helped build while there. It's a beautiful campus, obviously. My rival at Berkeley, but I gotta give it to him. It's, like, the prettiest campus in the world. And then, you know, all the way to the point where he, you know, upon his retirement year recently, over the last few years, has helped me actually build this physical space that we have in Napa with One Hope, and be my eyes and ears with our contractor and architect, and see all of his, you know, decades of work in the space come to fruition as a big part of our vision too. Just really cool. So tangibly connected to my success, and then also in the sense of raising me and having me being connected to it. And they also, you know, I was lucky to be the middle boy of two sisters too. And so I think that's a big part of who I am as well. And why I've been able to build such great things largely with women around me. So.
Yeah. It's really great to hear how your family played a part, and it must be rewarding to kind of see that come full circle, see the things that you learned from them, you know, paying off in your own business, and then to get your dad involved. That's gotta be great.
Yeah. He's a super talented volunteer, and, and he, I also can trust him obviously to the nth degree. So it's a good combination when you're building something, but watching people build things and watching your parents build things, I think makes you, it kind of innate in you. And so you're really fortunate if you're around people who are builders. And I just happen to have them as parents, and I happen to have a lot of friends and incredible people around me as well that inspired me to want to build.
Well, coming from the Bay Area, of course, it comes to mind, you know, what role does technology play in your company currently and in the long-term vision?
Yeah, technology is really one of our, you know, core elements to our identity at One Hope, and one of our big differentiators, and one of the things that makes us, you know, very disruptive and defensible in a lot of ways as well. We power a community of over 10,000 people around the nation to put on 3,000 to 4,000 events every month. And these are wine tasting events that are also fundraisers. And so there's a lot of things going on there. You know, our cause entrepreneurs are earning a commission and earning an income off of these events. The people that they're putting the event on that we refer to as the host, sometimes it's them, but a lot of times it's someone else who wants to raise money for their cause of choice. So tracking, you know, donation towards their cause of choice with every sale, and then facilitating the ability for our cause entrepreneurs, our sellers, to be able to manage their customer database and to market the brand and to check people out from a point of sale standpoint and to sell online and all these things. It all takes technology. And so our technology is focused on removing friction from their ability to share wine and give hope, which is our mission every day. And so if we're doing things that are solutions to make it easier and more scalable for them to share wine and give hope, then we're building the right technology. And technology is also what makes the user experience feel really easy and feel really connected. And so just continually trying to optimize how our user interacts with us. And our technology is about optimizing the relationship between sellers, buyers, and our company and our brand.
Well, there's a lot of consumers and buyers out there that are going through this smooth experience that don't realize how much work goes in to make it. So I really commend you with that. Having used your website and everything before, it's really commendable what you've built. And I think people really appreciate the experience they have, even if they don't understand all the work that's gone in.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like you really nailed it if they don't even think about it, you know?
Exactly.
And I think for our cause entrepreneurs, they have all these business tools. So it's kind of like Airbnb, you know, they're logging into their dashboard. They can see their commissions. They can track orders and help their customers, like, you know, change the shipping address or have it held at a local CVS or Rite Aid. And like, as you're giving people more tools to make the experience better for their customers, we're both empowering the customer and this B2B2C relationship.
Yeah. So I know I read that you guys have donated over $7 million via your sales. And I'm curious though, can you give us kind of the basics of how One Hope works, what the idea is, and how you've generated that $7 million?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, yesterday we celebrated 8 million. So,
oh, well, congratulations.
On December 8th. Thank you. So we do a combination of things. When we think about kind of this people-powered giving platform that we have, first and foremost, sustainability in our packaging and our processing and our distribution of our product. Secondly, we think about our cause entrepreneurs and putting money in the pockets of our cause entrepreneurs instead of the standard traditional distributor network. And the idea of putting money in the pockets of, you know, over half of these people are moms is a really cool purpose-driven thing in and of itself. With every product we sell, we build a portion in to go into our One Hope Foundation. And that's really to serve the causes that our company and our team really cares about, which is greater access to food, water, health, and education. And so we'll do things like fund meals. We funded millions of meals for people fighting hunger. We've funded building schools all across the world. We've funded tons of different water projects that bring clean drinking water to people. And so that's what we choose to give to. And we really believe that when you give people greater access to food, water, health, and education, you're helping break the cycle of poverty. And lastly, we've created a platform where our cause entrepreneurs and the people who are hosting events can also give back to their cause of choice. So they get to choose where 10% of their sales goes to different causes that they care about. And that's our biggest point of donation now in the company is through that part of the platform. And you have people all over the country raising money for people and causes they care about. And the wine generates donations, but the wine also pulls people together to learn about a cause that they can get passionate about. And then they end up making direct donations as well.
So could any organization or somebody with a cause come on and use your platform, or do you guys pick who gets to use it? How does that work?
Yeah, basically any nonprofit that wants to raise money or any individual that wants to raise money can use our wine and our tech platform to set up an event and raise money through the sales of wine.
That's awesome. That's a really cool opportunity that I hope nonprofits continue to use and to grow that opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. And there's information on our website about it. So there's people who join us because they want to earn an income and make an impact. And there's some people who come to us who just want to raise money for their cause. And we're happy with any and all.
Yeah, that it's a great way to do it. I appreciate that. It's kind of flexible opportunity. It's not too rigid. Obviously, different things work better for different situations. So, and I appreciate that you guys support, you know, people regardless of that situation.
Yeah, definitely. It's building up a people-powered giving platform was really like the bigger focus from an early stage than building a wine company per se. Yeah. So when I talk about One Hope, I'm always like, you know, the one is about bringing people together. It's actually what our service is. People think about our service as being wine tastings, but it's actually bringing people together. And our product is not wine, it's hope, you know? And so in One Hope, you're bringing people together around hope and through hope, and you're doing it through wine.
Well, I love the cause-centric commerce concept that you've pushed here and sort of shown us here. I've seen a lot of other businesses pick up on it. My vaporizer company, Dip Devices, you know, we donate to important causes for based on different colors of our devices. And I've seen other brands doing similar things. And I think a lot of that inspiration has come from you guys, that it must be feel nice to see other brands sort of getting on board with the concept.
Yeah, it does. It's really nice to see that trend and companies that, you know, are doing it year round too, and they're making it core to who they are.
Exactly.
Been really cool to see that transition. Cause marketing had been around for a long, long time, you know, and this temporary marketing relationship between a brand and a nonprofit to generate more sales and to put money in the pockets of the nonprofit. But the idea of cause-centric commerce, it's actually a phrase I developed out with the guy who created cause-related marketing at American Express. They were the first ones to ever use that phrase. And really, it was a Statue of Liberty restoration project. Jerry Welsh, he had a dollar donated for every new card sign up and a penny for every transaction. And they were able to fund the restoration of the Statue of Liberty, where for like decades, they couldn't raise enough money to actually like get it restored. And so it was this massively successful campaign. And I remember talking through it with him, and he said, you know, cause-related marketing was and is a great thing, but we need to do more. And businesses need to be the main platform for solving the world's biggest challenges. And more than just a marketing campaign, they need to be committed to it year round. And so we sought out to create a phrase for describing that, cause-centric commerce, is what we came up with.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that your efforts and One Hope really exemplify the fact that business truly is the most powerful vehicle for change. That American Express story emphasizes that as well. And I'm excited to see that evolve as you move forward.
Yeah, same here. I'm stoked that you guys are doing that with Dipper. And it's cool how you guys have executed it too, in the look and feel of each of them, and associated it with different causes, because people care about these things, and they're what differentiate. Like if all things are equal, if they feel good about your product and they feel like your brand is aligned with their values, they'll wear it as a badge of who they are, you know?
Exactly.
That's what brands are about. Combination of trust, values, the people behind them, and really stories and memories that they have with experiencing that brand. And so when you can connect all those things, it really is magical.
Yeah, that goes a really long way, and certainly appreciate that. What do you see for the future of One Hope?
Well, I think in the next couple of years, we're going to be the largest direct consumer wine brand in the U.S. And then I think between now and then, it's really about setting ourselves up to be the largest direct consumer wine marketplace. And so I think we'll expand brands that we own, and we'll also expand into winery partners for brands that we don't own, but elevate our brand by being around them, and be an alternative route to market for them to be sold into households through our wine club and through our community of customers. And then I think beyond building the largest wine marketplace in the U.S., the final step for us, and maybe it's not the final, but like our big vision is to build the most purpose-driven marketplace in the world, starting with wine though. And so we're very focused on wine, but we know that if we can ship wine, which is like one of the most compliant, unfriendly, heavy, hard to ship products ever, then we can ship a lot of other stuff in that same box. And you get to unit economics on a 4 bottles of wine. And after that, it costs less than $1 a unit to add another few pounds to the box, each bottle. And so, you know, that could be replaced with candles, glasses, wellness, dippers, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's really exciting to think about building out this concept with something that is very complex in terms of logistics, and to imagine the areas where you could apply it. Excited to see where those efforts go, and excited that you're sort of figuring it all out with such a difficult product.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited also to see where we can go beyond wine, and we're already doing it. Like if you go onto our website, you can put a gift add-on with your bottles of wine, and we've configured our packaging to where the wine ships very comfortably with the gifts, and it's the beginning of starting to ship non-wine products along with our wine.
Nice. So I believe you're involved in some other wine brands as well. Are there any in particular that you're excited about?
Well, yeah, we have two other wine brands in our portfolio. One's called Estate 8, and that's kind of our sister wine brand. It's also the name of the private home that's behind me in the picture. And it's because there's 8 master suites in the home. And then it's also what we call our community of owners, our Estate 8 community. And so we kind of created this sub brand that comes off the property, very small production, just allocated with our 2020 collective. And then we built another brand with John Elway called Seven Cellars. Mm-hmm. And Seven Cellars was my best shot at creating a name that wasn't John Elway wine, but it celebrated, you know, his lucky number 7, and very much celebrated his career and his brand, but also had the ability to scale into more than just wine as well as a brand, and be in alcohol in general. And so It's been fun building that with him, and it's grown into a nice, great quality, one first and foremost, but also fairly fast growing and high volume brand that we've created there too.
Awesome. Well, living in Denver, I tend to see John Elway's name quite a bit.
I'm sure you do. Yeah, probably more than most of us. And I forget that he's affiliated with a lot. He's a big brand there in Colorado. There's no doubt. So.
You know, I know that you're also a cannabis entrepreneur like I am, and I'd be curious to hear, you know, what got you into cannabis and how that kind of aligns with what you're already doing.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I first got into cannabis in full transparency, selling it in college. So I learned branding and distribution first and foremost with cannabis, not wine. But I also realized as it went from a hobby and hooking my friends up to being at a little bit more scale than that, that, you know, if I kept doing that after I got out of school, I wasn't, kid anymore. So there were some real consequences. And luckily I was in California, and even furthermore, I was living in Berkeley. So you're in about the best place you could be at that time. But I had such a passion for the product because I stopped drinking in college for the most part, because I had such a rigorous sports schedule, and my body just can't recover from alcohol very well. And so I really discovered cannabis in college as something that was fun for me and allowed me to relax. And I just loved the product. And so I was always getting my hands on it. And ultimately it turned out that I was better at getting my hands on it than most of my friends. And all of a sudden you go from hooking up your friends to realizing like, oh, I was just doing this to get free cannabis, to now it's a little bit more than that. And I had a product I would get from Humboldt all the time. I had a supplier there, and it was like such good quality stuff I was getting for a while, but there was no name or strain to it. It was just his private label stuff. And so I started calling it Humboldt Fog because I just didn't have a name, and everybody wanted to know what the name is of it. And so it was really my first brand. I'd be like, this is Humboldt Fog. You know it's Humboldt Fog. And I'd take it and I'd put it against the wall and I'd pound it against there. And I'd be like, because it sticks to the wall. and it was really sticky cannabis. People started coming back and being like, dude, do you have any of that Humboldt Fog? And I'd be like, sorry, I'm out. I just have, fill in the blanks. And so I started realizing, I'm like, oh, this has demand because it's a good name. And so I bought that URL long before I knew that it was going to become like a really popular cheese. Because I wasn't buying like $30 a pound cheese at that time. So turns out Humboldt Fog is like one of my favorite cheeses too. But that was my first enclave into the cannabis space. Another decade later, I'm sitting with a buddy of mine who's a very successful entrepreneur up here in Napa and has built one of the great wine brands here. And he just helped us find the property that that we ended up buying for One Hope. And where we built the winery and home, the one behind me. And I find he's 20 years my senior. I knew he went to Berkeley too. So I finally brought up the conversation about smoking cannabis. And I was like, hey, Eric, how do you feel about cannabis? And he goes, first of all, I've been smoking it since before you were born. and he was like, secondly, I think it's gonna be huge here. And that's when we had the original idea to found the Napa Valley Cannabis Association and to create an organization that would act kind of like the Napa Valley Vintners in the wine industry here in Napa, and really think about Napa as it pertains to cultivation and sales of cannabis and promotion of cannabis, and make sure that anything that had Napa affiliated with it was of the utmost quality. And to help kind of manage the way that cannabis enters into Napa, because we've created such a beautiful thing here in with regards to the wine industry. And so both to protect it and promote it as one of the great, if not the greatest, cultivation regions in the world. So.
Awesome. Yeah, I think it pairs well with the area and what you're doing, and I appreciate your support of cannabis and its growth and ending the war on drugs.
Yeah, you know, when I started realizing that cannabis wasn't just a social drug for me, but it was a plant that allowed me to not have to depend on any other drugs in my life. Like, I barely use ibuprofen, you know, but I'm on no medication stuff, but I do handle, you know, whenever I'm feeling a sense of anxiety or I do want to be inspired creatively, it's such an amazing product for me. And it also allows me to connect with people at a deeper level. And so I look at all of those reasons why. I mean, even with you, are a lot of my favorite times talking with you have been while we're burning one, you know, and I think it's a really special thing. It's not a drug to me. It's not even a plant to me. It's a lifestyle, and it's a community. And it's something that gives us the best chance, I think, to also wean our society off of opiates and all the other shit that we do to ourselves to try to make ourselves feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every single thing you just said, you're preaching to the choir here. I agree with you 1,000%, and certainly brings people together. It's a safer alternative to a lot of other substances. And, you know, I appreciate the support around it. I mean, the sad part is that there's still people in jail for this plant, and we still have a lot of work to do on the drug policy and criminal justice reform fronts around it, but we're moving in the right direction.
There's no doubt, Jeff. We give back with the products that we sell under our brands, because Eric and I, in addition to Napa Valley Cannabis Association, launched a couple of brands, and with each of them, we give back towards the Last Prisoner Project. And it's an awesome organization that does just what you're talking about, helping get people back into work after coming out of prison, and then also advocacy for people who are still in prison for stuff that I was doing at college, you know? And I obviously come from a very fortunate place to where I was never worried about going away to jail. It never even occurred to me that that would happen to me for selling a little bit of cannabis, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. And I'm sure we could talk about that all day, but I'll continue on, and, you know, that work's moving in the right direction. And, you know, on another topic though, I know you're involved in some things outside of wine. And one in particular I find really interesting is your advisory with 8VC.
Yeah. Yeah, ABC, I think, is, you know, up there in that top, you know, percentile of returns and just, I think, brand, really, when it comes to investing. And I'm really, really fortunate to be affiliated with their team there. As an advisor, I get to every once in a while send them interesting deals. Get to be a part of the community, and have tried to introduce, you know, really thoughtful investors and people who are value adds to their community too. And yeah, it's been a really fun ride to get to watch that team build and stuff. And one of my childhood friends, Joe, who founded it, he is, you know, a person I admire a lot, and is a huge believer in freedom, and is very honest and speaks his mind all the time. And he's just the best builder. I mean, the guy is, I don't even know how to describe him, but he's a machine. And there's only like a few of those in every generation. And so you just look at the amount of things he's touching and building, and how many people are connected to his ingenuity and just his relentlessness to build. And I'm always proud to be affiliated with both him, and then the team he put around himself is amazing. And so it keeps me kind of up on my game as far as understanding what the next generation is building. And I'm 38 right now, and so I'm still generally young. I'm like the old end of the millennial generation, but even I am like, we're starting to hire engineers that were born in 2000, you know, and I'm like, whoa. I think things are always moving fast, and they're only moving faster. And so it's really about staying sharp and keeping your finger on the pulse of what the latest and greatest is. And that ABC gives me an opportunity to do that. So.
Yeah, it's cool that you have the chance to work with them, and also seems like a great outlet for your creativity and for your networking. It's fantastic. And having, you know, spent a little bit of time with Joe myself, he certainly has shown all the things that you say about him. And, you know, he comes off as an incredible guy that is a builder, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's hard to name somebody who I've met that's smarter and harder working. And so it's like when you're smarter and harder, it's like, it's hard to beat that. So he sets a good pace for all of his friends and partners around him. There's no doubt. Yeah. I like having pace setters around me. And he's just a leader. So.
Yeah. Sounds like a great influence to have in your life. And, you know, to move on to another topic, I know you do a lot of work with the North Bay Foundation.
Yeah, actually, the North Bay Relief Foundation, we just rebranded it to After the Fire. And so I probably have to update that here soon. But that's been a great honor being on the board there and getting to help communities after they've been hit by, you know, a fire that just takes the wind out of their sails, and helping them rebuild and reimagine. And we had to help the community do that back in 2017. When the wildfires really destroyed a lot of homes through Sonoma and Napa and everything. And we did a really good job of it as a community. And it's what really connected me to the community here. I had just moved here like a little over a year before. And so I was still relatively like an outsider. And once I went through that and got involved in the community and raised a lot of money for a lot of different causes that were important to me, ranging from, you know, immediate relief with a good group called Good 360, providing basic needs and stuff for these shelters and things where people had to go to. So like mattresses, clothes, hygiene, stuff like that. Good 360, by the way, amazing organization where you pay, you know, the cost of shipping an entire truckload of goods to the spot where you're going. And they're all donated from the big guys like Home Depot and Walmart and stuff and whatever goods they have left over. And so you'll get like $250,000 to $300,000 of goods for the cost of shipping that container here, like 15 grand goes a long way. So got to do that, volunteer firefighter groups, even this group that collected like over 300 different types of acorns to preserve every species of oak trees, which are really special to us here in Napa and Sonoma. And while doing that, I met a lot of these different organizations here in my local area versus with One Hope. It was really just like a lot of different global and national organizations. And then I made a donation to the North Bay Relief Fund and started learning about the work they were doing here. And then as we helped people get back on their feet around here, soon thereafter, you had Paradise come along, you had Washington, Oregon, all get hit by wildfires too. And so we started taking our learnings and our blueprints into those different areas and realized we're no longer just a North Bay organization. We're After the Fire, and we help people after the fire to rebuild with immediate relief and rebuilding and reimagining their life, you know.
It's great to hear that you're involved in that. Obviously, it's something that's incredibly impactful in your region and around the world these days. I'm sure you've seen some really devastating things around that. So it must be nice to be involved in trying to help with that.
Yeah, feeling like you can help and gives you hope, you know, and hope's really about believing that tomorrow is going to be better than yesterday and today, you know. And so I think whenever I see things like that, that like, really bring me to my knees. It always takes a minute, and then you regain your breath, and then you're like, okay, what can I do about it? And so that's been my mentality, and I have to be more choosing my time than ever, because our building our brand distribution technology business with One Hope, and then on top of it, the real estate and hospitality business is more than enough to keep me busy. And so, you know, and then being really excited about brands in the cannabis space and some of the government affairs there is just a whole nother layer. And so my other couple advisory spots in technology and then in giving back to the community that is right here around me are kind of the last little two things I've layered on. And I promised myself, I was like, no more. There's nothing else that you're going to work on. You got to nail all of these things. And then you can worry about one in, one out at this point, you know? But,
yeah, that's a good perspective to have. There's certainly a lot of us out there that pile on maybe more than we should. And it's important to do what you're doing and do it well. And, you know, maybe I come off as a little bit of a hypocrite with that because I do have quite a bit going on, but I do my best to try to keep it organized and to make sure that it's impactful.
Yeah, it's also about finding alignment, you know, like all of those things that I laid out are all very connected to each other. And they benefit from one another. And I feel like I'm learning with each of them. And so if I'm learning and staying sharp, then it's good for all of them. And so there are network effects if you choose wisely. You can't do everything though. And I think you have a nice healthy balance too. You're actually like one of the few guys I've met that you have this similar portfolio of interesting stuff that you're involved in. And I, like from the first time I met you, I could feel like a warmth and that you're very purpose driven and you're, you know, innovating in these spaces, but always looking at how they benefit beyond, you know, the bottom line. And so I think it's rare that I find somebody who's doing stuff in the consumer space and in some of these areas that are like new and emerging, if you will. And so I'm in the bootlegging industry, you know, I'm in alcohol, cannabis.
Yep.
And I love it. It keeps me excited, about the future.
Yeah. Likewise. I appreciate the kind words and, the work you do is certainly impacted a lot of people and a lot of communities and, you integrate impact into all of your work. And I'm curious, was there a time early on where it really hit you like, my work can really affect change? Did you have any kind of moment you saw something happen that was just like, wow?
Yeah, I've had a lot of them actually along my career.
Sure. But
one that stands out a lot is in April of 2019, which was, you know, what is that? It was 13 years, basically, almost to the day since incorporating the business. I went out to Guatemala to get to see our very first school being unveiled. And I went to this ribbon cutting ceremony and the whole entire community came out. It was like over 1,000 people came, and I'm in this rural area, like 4 hours outside of the capital. And I'm looking at this amazing new school that they have compared to the nothing they had before. And these this new brand new bathrooms and water systems, which is like the cleanest drinking water that they had in the whole village, right? and actual hygiene, because like education to us is, you know, a part of their curriculum, but there's also like hygiene education so people don't die from things like diarrhea and like stuff like that. And so it was very impactful for me to see the kids, you know, that were going to be going to this new classroom. It's 270 kids that were starting there and another like 50 coming up the next year and probably every year after. But really seeing like the grandparents and kind of the twinkle in their eyes of probably never thinking they'd see the day where their grandkids were getting this type of an education and feeling that hope of breaking the cycle of poverty. That was life-changing to me. And also on my way home, I went where a lot of us go when we give and then start to think like, man, it's not enough, you know? And I was on my way home to knowing how much we had put into building our property and kind of doing the quick math of like, man, we could have funded almost 1,000 schools with how much it's costing to develop out this property, and feeling a little bit of a sense of guilt, obviously, from that. But I shifted my thinking from that time forward. And I said, you know, this property needs to be a place where we fund over 1,000 schools in our lifetime and thousands of water projects. And
you're investing in the future by investing in the property.
That's right. And so I kind of created a mission just for the property in and of itself, let alone for One Hope, was that it would fund, you know, millions of meals, thousands of schools, thousands of wells and clean drinking water and change even way more lives than I could have with just the investment into the property. And so that was a life-changing trip in general, not just that day, but the aftermath and the amount of thinking that I did on my way home from it.
Yeah, I can imagine. And my next question actually aligns with that pretty well. I like to ask my guests if there was an experience from childhood that showed you the importance of giving back, you know, regardless of which side you were on. And I think a lot of those kids at that school now have one of those experiences.
Yeah, exactly. And I only did the first few sentences in Spanish because I couldn't put the crowd through the pain of trying to do the whole thing. And so I had a translator there, and I shared that. I said, I was a kid, just like all of you guys, at one point, and maybe there's one of you, maybe there's a bunch of you that go and start a business someday, that gives back to your community or gives back to another community that needs it. I really do believe that. I think when we think about nourishing the future, you know, it's, you don't get to see all that work that gets done. When you build a school, you're not going to see the impact. It's one thing to quantify a school built, but it's like, what happens from that? And how does it affect the future of that whole community? And even though we'll never really know and we'll never really see it, you do it anyways, because you know that it just works. And so, yeah, I think as a child, I saw a couple of different things that made me realize like what I wanted to do and what I wanted to build. You know, I kind of shared about my parents' impact already and seeing what my mom building a business, how it changed people's lives who worked there. But I've also seen a number of times where a charitable donation changed the course of history for a family or for a whole community.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how those events can affect our lives and ideally fuel more of them. And you know, you've talked about throughout our conversation some awesome people along the way that have helped you get where you are, whether that's your family, people from your childhood, people like Joe. Has there been anyone on the journey that you specifically considered a mentor?
Oh yeah, a lot of people. Our chairman of our board, a guy named Eric Anderson, is a great creative and engineer at the same time. And he weaves between the two. He's kind of recognized as the modern founder of Topgolf, and is just a real genius when it comes to understanding experience and community while also having an incredible financial mind. I consider Joe a mentor, friend, and partner, and he kind of plays all these interesting roles, being basically my same age, a little bit older than me. There's a guy named Stan that I ran into early on who, you know, the business wouldn't be around if it wasn't for him, and taught me a lot about building relationships and trust with people. You know, I think about my grandma and my mom as two of my biggest business role models, but also mentors on how to build an organization and how to be a leader and stuff. A guy named Jack Clark, who is my rugby coach at Cal, and almost every player would tell you they didn't like him as much while they were playing for him as they do now. But you look back and he was the first person to show me what it took to build a championship level program, you know, year in and year out. And so there's a lot of them along the way, mentors and coaches that I have. I'm not short on it.
Well, I think a lot of the best coaches in life and in athletics specifically, that is often the case. You know, you maybe hate them for a minute while you're with them, and then you realize how much you gain from them, how much you learn from them. I earlier in my podcast had on Mo Brown, who played football at the University of South Carolina, and he talked about both a coach from when he was a kid that taught him, you know, to treat your equipment with respect and things like that, and then to having Steve Spurrier as his coach and all the things that he instilled in him. So it's really incredible to see the long-lasting impact that figures like that can have in someone's life.
Definitely. And if you surround yourself with good people, you can get coaching everywhere, you know. Some of the people that I'm their direct report. They're some of my best mentors and coaches too. And it's about building a honest relationship and being vulnerable enough to let them in and try to make you better. And so I think about having a lot of mentors and coaches out there, and I'm always trying to learn. So.
Yeah, I think that's a really important perspective, always trying to learn and knowing that regardless of who's in what position or what role, you can learn from everyone in one way or another.
Yeah, if you do that, then you find that your teammates are willing to do that too. And they're like, oh, wow, the person who's quote unquote under me can actually teach me too and coach me and lead me. And it's like, just because you're the leader and you lead in some elements, like you can't lead everything in an organization. You have to be a follower and a role player on certain things. And so I try to be the best at a few things in our company. And once it gets outside of the 10% of things where I'm really passionate about the decision and I'm the best one to make it, I tend to try to look to the people who I can trust to lead me in the right direction. So
we've reached that part of the conversation where if you'd like, you're welcome to ask me a question.
You asked me a bunch of things about the driving force and what makes me tick on different things. What would you say you want to define your career when looking back, when you're, you know, that old man in a rocking chair?
Well, that's a great question. I would say that I could come at it from a lot of different perspectives. First and foremost, I want people to see the people that I've collectively helped with those on my team. And in general, you know, something I've talked about a few times in these podcasts is my dad's, you know, mantra was always tikkun olam, repair the world. And it's something that I try to integrate into everything that I do. And so I hope that when you look back on my endeavors, that it shows that I did my part to try to make the world a better place and to honor the situation that my parents and grandparents put me in. You know, you talked a little bit about immigrants earlier. My grandparents were immigrants. My dad was an immigrant. And for me, you know, living up to all of the strife that they went through and the surviving that my grandparents went through in the Holocaust to give me an opportunity to have any kind of life, I want it to be clear that I tried to make the most of their efforts and honored them.
That's awesome. I feel the same way. My mom's side of the family comes from a similar place. And so, but really both sets of grandparents have, like, I was lucky they worked really hard to put my parents in the position they were in. And then my parents worked really hard to put me in the position. And so there is this sense of duty and civic duty that I've always had kind of innately in me because of them. And so we're lucky that we, with it comes great responsibility. I think you choose to take on that responsibility as a leader in society. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate that. And, you know, having an 18-month-old, that gave me a new perspective on it. I am now tasked with the responsibility of making sure that, you know, I don't want him to feel guilted or burdened, but I want him to feel some responsibility in terms of how he lives his life and how he gives back. And I have the duty now to instill that in him.
That's cool, man. You probably didn't know it because I didn't either. But the night that we had some scotch at the Broadmoor out on that that grass, that was the night that Megan and I created our first baby. So,
oh wow!
So we're about 18 weeks away from having our first child. And it was from that weekend, which is pretty
cool. That's amazing. Congratulations. That's so exciting. Please keep me posted.
I will, definitely. It's we're very excited about it. And so I'm going to be jumping into that next stage and next chapter with you, hopefully. Yeah. So,
I'm excited to see how it kind of affects your perspective on life and what you're doing. And, you know, we'll have another conversation when you're a little bit further along in it.
That sounds great, man. I'm looking forward to it.
So there's a question I've been asking all my guests, and it's been really interesting to see what the answers are like, how they relate, how they differ. But the question is, if you could snap your fingers and fix one thing in the world, what would it be? And how do you think that change would reverberate?
If I could snap my fingers, it'd probably be something related to mental health and getting people to like figuring out a way to get people back to a place of joy and getting them off their screens a little bit more. I think the way to do that is by creating opportunities to connect and you know, through those means to get them connected to you, but to bring them in back into the physical world and to connect with each other. I think the metaverse and the direction we're going is interesting. And I know it's inevitable that we're gonna live in a couple of different places ultimately. But I think human connectivity is super important. And so that would be it. I mean, that and empathy, you know, and I think the combination of the two are kind of, they're cyclical references to each other. Having empathy for one another and being able to find joy in life, I think I would wish that for everybody. You know, I think we're a long ways away from it right now.
Yeah, but absolutely, what a better place the world would be if we could just inject people with empathy and compassion. Yes. And, you know, we won't get into this full conversation that it could be, but I think that in terms of the revolution that's going on around cannabis and psychedelics, you know, I think we're heading in the right direction in terms of changing people's mindsets. And hopefully you and I and our children live in a world that is more compassionate and empathetic.
Yeah, I sure hope so. And I think, you know, we're working at it. We're working at ways to bring people together. We're working at products that bring people happiness and joy and connectivity. And I agree with you. I like the trend that we're seeing with legalizing some of these things with used responsibly, bring that to people in a more sustainable and healthy and natural way. And I think a lot of the places where we find our perceived happiness are in the least organic and least natural ways. And we've kind of tricked ourselves into thinking that they're normal, but they're not. And I think, you know, I think that we'll save the rest of that for a longer conversation over a glass of wine together.
Looking forward to it. So people that are listening certainly are inspired by what you're doing. I can assure you of that. And I know they're going to be wondering how best they can support you and your impact. They can go to the One Hope Wine website. You know, what are other ways they can support you and your work?
Yeah, onehopewine.com for sure. And then for anybody who is a wine collector or really passionate about leaning into our community more, there's an area in there to join the 2020 collective or apply for it. That's an area where, you know, this smaller group of people can really help support the mission that we're on. If you're a business owner and you want to give awesome client gifts that kind of make people feel like you made a donation on their behalf and they get an awesome bottle of wine or two, we make for a great gifting, our gift during the holidays and anytime during the year. And so those are all kind of like monetary, and transactional things, but I think also, just by, sharing our message and being supportive of, businesses, young businesses, up and coming ones, in spaces that are developing, you know, it progresses our message, getting behind cause-centric commerce, building a purpose into your business. That's a great way to support and honor really the platform we're trying to build. I guess as far as thinking about the future of the brand, if you're ever in Napa and you look us up, hit us up and hopefully we'll be able to get you into the tasting room. We have one of the most aspirational experiences in the Napa Valley right here. And it really is a special place. So there's a lot of ways to connect with us and join our community. We also have cause entrepreneurs all over the nation who earn an income and make an impact with us every day. So doing that and or hosting an event, there's so many ways you can attach yourself to us. But going to onehopewine.com, you can kind of navigate through what fits you best. And so that's where I would start. And then anything beyond that, you know, is a bonus.
Awesome. Well, I'll be sure to include all those links and also link to After the Fire. And, you know, we really appreciate you giving this time today and sharing your story with the world. And I look forward to hopefully seeing you soon and continuing that conversation and wishing you and your wife all the best.
Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate you and look forward to the next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of People Are the Answer. To find out more, go to peoplearetheanswer.com.